homicide occurred at the residence of Betty Jane McClellan and Jacob Albert McClellan. What had occurred was an unknown actor approached the victim's residence, which was a trailer, came to the front door under the guise of needing some assistance with his vehicle, at which point in time he pulls out a weapon. Jacob McClellan, who's 66 years of age at the time, attempts to fight off said actor, but he's overpowered, at which point in time the actor pulls out what appears to be a semi-automatic handgun and proceeds to fire twice, striking Mr. McClellan in the neck and also in the face. Mr. McClellan then drops to the floor where he's laying. Actor then proceeds inside the residence and locates our victim for the homicide, Betty Jane McClellan, at which time we don't know what transpires other than what's told to us by Jacob. There's shots heard. And when Jacob goes back in to check on his wife, he finds her in the bedroom, the master bedroom of the trailer or residence, and she is apparently in the process of dying as a result of a gunshot wound. She does, upon arrival of police and paramedics, she is deceased. Jacob's taken to the hospital and he's treated for his gunshot wounds.
One thing that has stuck with me this whole time, the line at the funeral home was so long. And some people said they waited for 3 hours in line to get into the funeral home. There was a woman who went to school with Mom. And most people would hug us and say, "I'm so sorry," and things like that. This woman just walked in there and she just stood there in front of me and she just said, "I don't know what to say." And she walked on.
Welcome to the Catch My Killer podcast. Thank you for listening. My name is Mark. Since 2015, I've written a weekly column about unsolved homicides and true crime for the Claremont Sun newspaper in Ohio. This week, we delve into the story of an unsolved homicide that occurred in Greene County, Pennsylvania in 2009. Before we begin this week's story, I would like to ask for your support. I'm asking listeners to buy me a $5 cup of coffee every month in order to help support this podcast. This will help cover costs associated with producing it. I would appreciate any help that you can provide. So please visit catchmykiller.com and click on the donate link or the buy me a coffee link. And if you cannot buy me a coffee, you can still help out by sharing these stories with your friends and family members through word of mouth and social media. And that's enough of the coffee business. Morris Township, Greene County, Pennsylvania, was the site of this week's unsolved homicide. Betty Jane McClellan, an elderly grandmother, was shot to death inside her mobile home during a home invasion in 2009. She was home with her husband, Jake. He was shot twice, but he did survive. After her divorce in 1976, Betty Jane McClellan moved to Western Greene County, a rural area in Pennsylvania, with her four children. Her church and community embraced her. She worked at a local restaurant for nearly 20 years. Patty Friend, whose family owned the restaurant, often referred to Betty as her right hand. Betty worked at the restaurant and then worked in the office, and then she later returned to manage the restaurant. Betty's children loved their mother. She attended all the events that her children participated in. Betty devoted herself to her children and made sure they had a good life growing up. Sadly, they would lose their mother to a horrific homicide. Betty J. McClellan and her husband Jake were at their mobile home on the night of March 22nd, 2009. Just before 10 p.m., there was a knock at the door. As Jake answered, he saw a white male with shoulder-length brown hair pulled back into a ponytail. He was asking for help with a flat tire. Jake told him to wait outside. The man barged into his home with a gun and demanded money and guns. A fight ensued between Jake and the unknown man. The intruder shot Jake twice, once in the cheek and once in the neck. Jake immediately fell to the ground. He then heard another gunshot coming from the rear of his mobile home as his wife Betty screamed. Jake panicked and ran outside and hid between two parked cars in the front yard. As he lied on the ground, he saw a white van slowly approaching his property. Jake saw the shooter run out of the house holding a bag or a pillowcase. The shooter approached the van driver and they exchanged words for about 10 seconds before the shooter got into the passenger side and the van sped away. Jake flagged down another vehicle to call for help. And when police arrived, they discovered Betty dead inside the mobile home. Jake survived after being airlifted to a local hospital. There was also another witness who did see the white van. Furthermore, when police began investigating the case, they wondered if there was a connection between Betty Jane's death and an elderly man named Noel Wine, who was killed just 15 miles away from where Betty and Jake lived. Noel Wine was also a junk dealer like Jake McClellan. Wine was killed several months before Betty. According to the autopsy, Noble was shot twice in the head with the same type of weapon as Betty and Jake. Were Betty and Noble Wine's homicides related? It must be considered a serious possibility. Jake McClellan described the killer as a white male between 5'7" and 5'8" and weighing between 150 to 170 pounds. He had brown shoulder-length hair. Although the police do not consider Jake a suspect, Betty's children are not so sure. Since their mother's murder, they have been suspicious of Jake. They also don't know if the home invasion occurred as Jake said it did. The family also learned that Jake had collected proceeds of a substantial life insurance policy after their mother's death. The family didn't know about this policy until after their mother was killed. Shelley James, who is one of Betty's daughters, said that law enforcement confirmed the policy in a podcast interview. Jake would move in with a new woman shortly after the funeral. What's especially troubling to the family is that the killer demanded money and guns. However, he left empty-handed. Betty had purses containing money, and there was an unlocked gun cabinet with guns inside. Why didn't the killer take the guns and money from the home if he broke in with the intention of stealing guns and money? Despite the family's suspicions of Jake, you have to consider that he was shot twice and the wounds were nearly fatal. For Jake to have been involved in this, he would have had to be willing to risk his own life. There was also the murder of another junk dealer further down the road using the same type of gun used on Betty and Jake. Jake described the shooter as leaving in a van with another man. A witness also saw the white van with two men in it. Despite Jake's claims, Betty's family thinks he knows more about her death than he has revealed. To solve this murder, the police must find the white van used as the getaway vehicle. As part of my research for this story, I discovered that there was a murder in 2011 that may be connected to the killings of Betty McClellan and Noble Wine. The police have never stated why they think that this other murder is connected. The police think Jake and Noble Wine may have been targeted because they both dealt in junk, which is a cash business. So who would kill an elderly grandmother who was a pillar of her community? She had no criminal record and didn't participate in any criminal acts that would cause anyone to want to harm her. Was this a random killing? For this week's story, I spoke to Betty Jane's daughter, Shelley James, about the unsolved murder of her mother, Betty Jane McClellan.
My mom was born in West Findlay, Pennsylvania, the rural area of Washington County. In 1938, my grandparents were farmers. She lived during the Depression, at the tail end of the Depression era, so they were very frugal on everything. My grandparents were very good about sending my mom and my aunt and uncle to church and getting that kind of religious background and just being a God-fearing, faithful person, and she was that. She was very heavily in the church. At one point, she was a Sunday school teacher, and she did the church newsletter, and she was in the Willing Workers, where they sewed quilts and did mission work and stuff. And she was a deaconess of the church, and she cleaned the church, and you name it, she was always at the church. So everybody knew her because she was in the choir. She sang horribly. She always had a smile on her face. And I don't know how many people said, oh, she must have had a beautiful voice, because all of us kids sing and played instruments and what have you. Mom couldn't hold a tune in a bucket, but she was always smiling. She was always up there, always wanting to make sure she was praising God in her way. She was very crafty. She sewed my sister Lisa's wedding gown. She sewed all the bridesmaids' dresses for my sister Sherry's wedding. She sewed my wedding gown. She's done so many dresses and stuff for us as we were kids, and she'd get the best deal on the worst polyester material, and she'd make us a zillion different things with it. Blues at Easter time and greens, and oh, it was awful. But she was a wonderful seamstress, and people would bring stuff to her to mend or to make, and she crocheted. She taught all of us how to crochet when we were young, and I went crazy with it during COVID. I don't know how many baby blankets and all kinds of stuff that I made, and I was like, this is dedication to Mom. So, but she, beautiful seamstress, beautiful crafter. And my older sister ended up showing her how to decorate cakes she had learned in high school. And so she taught my mom, and then my mom started decorating cakes, and everybody would call her and say, hey, I need a cake. And Mom was always right there. So anytime anybody needed something, they called Betty, and she was always willing to help. And for us kids, she was always there, no matter what we had going on, whether it was the band, something with chorus, something with a play, Girl Scouts. She was a den mother and everything for Girl Scouts and for Boy Scouts and brownies and everything. She was always part of us, always. Even when I went to college, she would drive 2 hours to come up and see me in college just to see me at a football game marching on the field. She's just that kind of person.
Sounds like a wonderful lady.
She was.
I was looking at pictures of her on the internet, and I thought, wow, she reminded me of my grandmother. Was the same way. She sewed, she did all those things, and she was such a good mother to my dad and his sister. And
yeah, it really makes you scratch your head as to why it happened to her.
Now, did she spend her entire life in Pennsylvania? She never had any desire to go to Florida or leave? She was just happy living in Pennsylvania?
She was totally content. There was one point when my mom and dad were still married, they moved to Michigan. And I don't know if you ever heard this story about when they were burning down Detroit. And my brother was maybe 6 or 7, and my sister was 1 or 2 years old. And so that's back in the early 60s. And my dad came home one night and said, if they're burning down the city, pack up the kids, we're going back to Pennsylvania. And they did. And that was the only time she ever lived outside of Pennsylvania.
Did your mom go to college? Did she have career goals?
Mom and dad got married. I think Mom was 19. She had Dave when she was 20. Dad was in the Air Force for a while. They were stationed in Valdosta, Georgia, whenever my brother was born. I guess that's one other place that she lived, but that was temporary. But yeah, she was Mom. I mean, she did maybe some work with my dad. He owned a company called Royalty Homes, and they did modular homes. And she helped with that some, but not really that much. She was the mom. She stayed home with us and took care of us.
I think that was a standard, wasn't it, in the 50s and 60s?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I think my grandmother did the same. She did work, but taking mm-hmm. care of the kids was a big priority.
Yeah. So, but then when my dad left, and back in the 70s, they didn't really go after deadbeat dads like they do these days. And my dad never paid child support, and so we ended up on welfare and food stamps and what have you. But Mom never wanted us to expect it or take advantage of it. It was a privilege because we didn't have the ability to support ourselves. And so it was always a goal that when we became adults, that we never got into that situation, that we had to be like that. And she did work some part-time jobs and stuff, but she had some back issues. And so health-wise, she couldn't do a lot of things. So she was limited, but she was always energetic. She loved taking care of people. She loved entertaining people. And she didn't let issues with my dad get her down. She was always about family. She was always involved with family reunions, class reunions. Her Claysville High School class of 56, they still have reunions and they still meet like once a month. Some of them meet and they always bring up my mom after all these years. And she meant a lot to them because she was always involved in making sure the reunions happened. And even she went to a one-room schoolhouse when she was in grade school and they had reunions and she was always involved in those. So she loved being part of family and friends and community, and that was her.
I had read that a restaurant she worked at still keeps a picture of her on the wall to this day. That's respect.
The livestock auction in Waynesburg, she worked as a waitress in the restaurant for several years, and then she managed it. So she went and did all the grocery shopping, and she cleaned, and she did all kinds of stuff. She worked there for several years. Her boss, the owner of the livestock auction, Patty Friend, just adored mom and just made her part of the family. And whenever mom passed away and we put up a reward fund, and she kept that jar on the counter for several years after that.
It sounds like she was well loved by the community.
The funeral, if you know anything about Greene County, it's very rural. The funeral home in Rogersville, Rush's funeral home, was where we had the funeral. And we had people from, I don't even know how many states came in, family and friends and what have you. But we had well over 1,000 people that came through that funeral home. And we only had one day of viewing. We had a 5-hour viewing. We didn't even stop in between because we were like, no, we just need to get through this. And because people are not going to stop anyways, so we're just going to continue through. And then we had the funeral the next day. And even the funeral director, he said, I've never had this many people at a funeral before. Oh my gosh. The walls were just covered in flowers. Like my sister said something about that it looked like the wallpaper was coming to life.
So tell me about the moment that you found out that your mother was gone. How did you find that out?
I heard a knock at the door around 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're dead asleep. And I heard something. I'm like, oh, I'm dreaming. And I kept hearing it. And I heard the doorbell. And I said to my husband, I said, somebody's at the door. And he was like, okay, I'm getting up. And he goes down and he saw a police officer outside. But then he sees three people standing on the porch and an ambulance outside because they were afraid I was going to go into shock. So he answers the door and they say, are you Shelly James's husband? And he said, yes. And they said, is Betty McClellan Shelly's mother? And he said, yes. And they said, we're sorry to inform you, but she was murdered last night. And I heard that and I screamed and came down the step and didn't fall over, but I was just like, no, this didn't happen. This didn't happen. And they were like, okay, calm down. And they got me settled down and sat down at the table and started talking about stuff. And I said, no, I said, this wasn't supposed to happen like this. I said, she's supposed to have a heart attack. She had a heart attack a year before, had recovered from it. Great, but you never know. And I said, no, I said, she wasn't murdered. She had a heart attack. And they were like, no, we're really sorry. And then they get into this whole discussion about Jake. And I said, I knew this was going to happen. And they were like, what are you talking about? And I said, I knew that something was going to happen when she married him. It was surreal. It was just like knowing that I had to then call my brother and my sisters. I couldn't do it. I turned to my husband and I said, you have to call them. And he was like, no way. I said, yeah, wait, you're going to have to call him because I can't do it. Yeah, that was not good. And then I told the detectives that were there, it was a detective and then two Call Your Township police officers that were from my township that I was living in. And I said, somebody needs to go and get my aunt's sister-in-law and take her to my aunt's house. Do not let her find out this information on the news. I said, somebody has got to go get her sister-in-law and take her to my aunt's so you guys can tell her together before she sees this on the news. Do you think they did it? No. I ended up having to call my aunt's sister-in-law and giving her the news. She knew that something had happened because they had a police scanner. Ambulances and police cars were going up and down the road anyways, and so they knew that something had happened. And so when I called her, she wasn't totally in surprise. But I told her, I said, you've got to go over to Juanita's, my mom's sister. I said, go over to Juanita's and tell her what happened. And that was not good.
When you first heard that she was murdered, I'm sure you were shocked because you're probably thinking, my mother's an elderly woman. Who would do this?
Right. And everybody loved her. Why would they do that?
So earlier you said that you figured something would happen to your mom after she got married to her second husband. With you saying that, how shocked were you that your mother had been murdered?
I was definitely shocked because, yeah, like I said, who would have done that to her? She was so special to so many people, but knowing Jake's background, knowing that his business dealings per se with his junk job that he had a tow truck and would tow people's cars, and he'd gather junk and take it to the junkyard to get money and stuff. And for what he had done to my mother's property, had damaged things and just made it such a mess. And that was one of the things that we were so afraid whenever they got married, that he was going to ruin her property, ruin her house and what have you. And he did. I think it got to the point where mom just gave up. And it was very hard to see her in that situation. And we saw her the day before. It was my aunt's 80th birthday party. And we had a surprise party for her. And so we had all been there together. There was probably close to 100 people there, which was wonderful that all of those people got to see mom for the last time, because it was the next evening. Because mom went over to my aunt Juanita's house and sat with her and opened up her birthday gifts and stuff. And they were writing out thank you cards. And so it was a really nice time for them to be together. And then that evening she got killed.
Was that the last time you spoke to her? Was the night before?
Yeah.
Do you remember your conversation with her?
Oh, I think a lot of it was around my aunt's party. She was so excited that she had pulled off a surprise, because my aunt had no idea that she was even planning anything. And a lot of it was around that and talking about what gifts that she got and just standard conversation.
And you probably never realized in a million years that would be the last time you would see your mother alive.
No, never.
Can you tell me about Jake? How did your mom meet him?
It's a small rural area. We grew up with his kids. We've known them since we were young. My husband said the first time he met him, he thought he was greasy and good at conning people into things. Patty, friend, had told me that before him and mom had got together, that he had been hanging out with this girl down at the livestock auction. He was down there all the time because he was just courting on anybody he could. There's so many better people in the world. And mom knew that none of us kids liked him. He had been trying to court her for 4 years. He started going to church with her and taking her out to dinner, and he'd come over and mow her yard and just take care of things. And she finally caved and said yes. And she did not tell us they were getting married until the weekend before. And they got married on Easter Sunday. And none of us kids went because we didn't agree with it. And we told her straight out that if she married him, things would be very different. My sister Lisa said, if you marry him, my niece would never spend the night at their house because she didn't trust Jake. And Sherry said that they were living out of state at the time. And she said, if we come in to visit, we won't stay with you. And they never did. It was hard dealing with holidays because he knew we didn't like him. And mom would come to us, especially at Christmas time. She'd say, can't you just get him a box of chocolates or something? Just something to say Merry Christmas. And I was just like, why? I don't like him. Why should I get him something if I don't like him? And it was hard because we adored our mom, and to see her with him just was really hard. And one day she comes over to my house and she's got this black eye and we're like, what the heck happened? And she said, oh, he didn't mean it. And it was like, what do you mean he didn't mean it? What did he do to you? And she said she was helping him with some repair on a car that he was working on, and some spring or wire or something broke and hit her in the face. And it was like, seriously? Really? Is that what happened? And that was the story. She was sticking to it. And you could see how her attitude was changing, how she just was being quiet. And that was a lot of what she did whenever my dad left. And it was like, it's all coming back.
It sounds to me as if she was just beaten down, both mentally and physically. She was probably just tired.
Yeah. It was sad because when my grandmother passed away, my grandfather had passed away several years before her. But so when grandma passed away and they sold the estate and everything and split up the inheritance, my mom bought a new mobile home. And she was so happy about it. She was so proud of it. And she just kept it pristine. She was always cleaning it, always making sure everything was in order and stuff. And she was a bit of a pack rat. She gained that off of my grandfather. But she wasn't a cluttery kind of a pack rat. She had method to her madness, and she knew how to stash things away. So you didn't realize how much of a pack rat she really was. But when her and Jake started having issues, that changed. And you could tell she just gave up. And when we went into the house a day or two after she had been killed, when the police let us in there, the place was a mess. There was just stuff everywhere. It was hard to see.
Now, what happened? Apparently, somebody knocked on their door, and then he just kind of barged his way in trying to rob your mom.
That's Jake's story. So he said that he knocked on the door and said that he had broke down the road and wondered if Jake could give him a tow. And so Jake said, yeah, let me get my jacket. And he said he closed the door to get his jacket on the rack behind the door, and the guy pushed himself in and shot Jake. And Jake said he fell on the ground, and he said he moved a little bit and the guy shot him a second time and it knocked him out. And so that was when the guy went for my mom. And Jake said that when he pulled my mom to the back, he kind of got revived and ran out of the house. And my brother says, yeah, because you're a coward, because you wouldn't even go and help protect your wife. So those are my brother's opinions there, which I believe the same thing, because I know the guy's got a gun, but don't you want to protect your wife? I know my husband would have. So Jake said he heard a gunshot. He was hiding behind a car that was sitting on the top of the bank, one of my mom's old cars. And he heard a gunshot and he saw the guy run out and get into a white van, and they took off. And he said at that point, he went back inside and said that my mom was barely breathing. And the police said that by the time they got there, that she had deceased.
I read that other people saw that same white van and that there was a driver. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Different people said that they had seen a white van in the neighborhood. Jake had told them there was already somebody in the van, and the person that came out of the mobile home had got in the passenger side.
What time did this happen?
Was late at night. I think it was around 9:30 at night.
I'll tell you what, I don't answer my door.
This is rural Greene County. You think you know everybody.
Still, was that a common thing for him, do you think, to just answer the door? Or was
especially with him doing the tow jobs and stuff. Yeah, he would get calls or people would stop by at various times.
So it wasn't like a situation where he never opened the door and then all of a sudden, just this one time, he opens the door and coincidentally he gets shot, right? And your mom gets killed. So it wasn't right. Like that. So people knock on the door all the time.
It's not like it happens every day, but it's not totally uncommon.
He probably just thought, hey, probably some guy that needs some help. and just open the door?
Definitely.
Would he open the door to a stranger?
Sure.
Okay.
And I was trying to remember even the layout of the trailer. I don't think there was a window. If there was a window on the door, I think it was frosted. So you wouldn't have really been able to see out. I don't think there was a window on that door.
He just blindly opened the door.
Yep.
That's dangerous.
Yep.
I definitely wouldn't recommend it. I don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. But like I said, it's rural and everybody knew each other. So you didn't think you had anything to fear.
And then Jake said the guy came in saying he wanted money and guns.
Yeah.
Did your mom have a substantial amount of money hidden in there? Or did she have guns?
Not hidden. So this is where it starts being questionable. Because if he was asking for money and guns, they didn't take them. Because in the front bedroom, there was a gun cabinet, still had guns in it. It was not locked. Because there wasn't any kids around, so it wasn't like they felt that it needed to be locked. There were at least two guns in the back bedroom where they shot and killed my mom. So at the livestock auction, and with the change that she got, depending on what kind of coins it was, my grandfather had been into coin collecting. He actually started all of us kids out with a penny collection. With a, I think it was a 1909 VBD something penny. And so all of us grandchildren had that book, and some of us continued the collection and others did not. I did, but mom was very much into collecting coins. So any of the state quarters or the Sacagawea dollars or bicentennial coins or buffalo nickels or anything out of the ordinary, she would keep those. If she saw one in the change drawer at the livestock auction, she would swap it for some change that she had in her pocket. And if you walk down the hallway, she had a little table sitting right at the edge of the hallway, and there were cups and jars and like candy dishes filled to the rim with coins. They were still sitting there.
What did this guy take?
I honestly do not believe they took anything. And that is something that I have questioned the police about heavily because, and I don't think this is anything that ever came up in, they never talked about it because they kept saying it's not proprietary. They keep it secret because they don't want it out in the public.
And that's a little confusing to me. You said the guy didn't take anything. So the guy goes in there, there's guns, there's coins of it right there. He takes nothing. But yet he shoots your mom's husband and he shoots your mom and he runs out empty handed.
Jake said he had a pillowcase and had taken stuff out of the house. I don't believe it. Even at that, if he took a pillowcase, which one? Because the pillows on the bed had pillowcases on them.
And how long was this guy in the house? I'm assuming that he wasn't in there very long. So he went in, shot him, shot your mother, and then he probably ran right out. So it didn't really sound like he would have a lot of time to take anything. And if he's asking for guns and money, why is he leaving the guns and change?
Yep. Mom even had a collection of purses and they were sitting in a pile behind her recliner. They were still there. And every single one of those purses, we went through the pockets and everything, and every single one of those purses had money in them.
It sounds to me like this individual's sole purpose was to kill your mother and maybe kill her husband because he got shot twice. Right. And that was it. I understand that people might think that the husband is involved. And of course, because any homicide case, they always look for the spouse or significant other. But do you really think that he would take two shots? And from what I understand, could have killed him, and that one of the bullets is still lodged in his body. There's cases where people do self-inflicted gunshot wounds, but they're in a spot where the person's not going to die. But from what I read, the shots that he took could have killed him. So anybody on the outside looking at this would think that he's probably not involved with this.
Yes and no. If you ask anybody in that neighborhood, they all think he had something to do with it. Even though he got shot, they all think he had something to do with it. Because we found out he had been cheating on my mom, and not with just one woman, with two. There you go again. Stuff like that, that we found out that mom had not put him on her checking account until 6 months before she died. Why? She had three very small life insurance policies. She had an old Gerber policy that my grandfather had got for her when she was little, and she had continued to pay on it. And I think it was only worth like $2,500. I was like, why did you keep a hold of this for so many years? I think the payment on it was minimal, but it was $2,500. And she had one that was, I think it was $5,000. And then she had this one that was $5,000 that it was double indemnity. Why did my mother have a life insurance policy that was double indemnity? Which basically means that if she was murdered or if she was killed in an accident in any way, that it doubled. So we got $10,000 out of that one. Why would she have that policy? And then we find out several years later, I get a call from Tara Kinsel, who was a journalist in the area. And we've known Tara since we were in high school. And we had stayed in touch because she was very curious in the case. And she calls me up and she said, you need to call the police. I said, what's going on now? And she said, I just got a call and I can't even remember the guy's name. He was one of mom's neighbors. And she said he was panicky. She said he said that Jake showed him a life insurance policy check that he had got on my mom for $150,000 and straight out said it was a double indemnity policy. My mother was meticulous about records, about keeping her checkbook up to date to the penny. She didn't do it on a computer on Quicken. She manually did it in her check registry. And there is nothing in there that shows a life insurance policy outside of the three small ones that she had. So why did Jake have a policy that was not paid? How did he pay it? Cash? Registered check, cashier's check. I don't know. But when I went to the police and told them about it and asked them if they could investigate it, they gave me some excuses and said they would get back to me. And they didn't. And I called them back and I said, what is it about this life insurance policy? And they said, we don't have the right security clearance for it. We're trying to contact the people to, you know, take care of that. I found out that was a bold-faced lie. And they kept delaying, and every time I would bring it up, it was one excuse after the other. Then the insurance agent had retired, and she didn't have access to the records anymore, and it was just one thing after another. And then if you listen to the Unsolved Mysteries podcast, he says straight in there, Jake had the policy. But that doesn't necessarily mean for murder. Well, I'm sorry, but in Greene County, $150,000 is a lot of money. And if you look at where Jake is now, he's with this woman down in Morgantown, West Virginia, and they flaunting themselves around very shortly after mom's funeral. He actually brought her and she stayed in the house with him the night after the funeral because neighbors told us she was there. And they now live in Morgantown, West Virginia, and built a new house. For guess how much? $150,000.
Were you able to confirm whether that existed or not?
Trooper Petrowski said it did. He said in the Unsolved Mysteries podcast that he did have the policy. And it was like, all these years you've been lying to us about this and you knew it. Why? But yet they still don't believe that he had anything to do with it.
Probably because of the gunshot wounds that he took.
Oh, yeah. And he passed a lie detector test. I'm sorry, a compulsive liar can pass a lie detector test.
They probably don't have any physical evidence to link him, is what I'm assuming. Now, did they find any DNA? Did they get any fingerprints? This guy must have left something, right? Did he didn't leave no fingerprints or anything?
My brother and my brother-in-laws were the first ones to go into the house. And they said there were pieces of carpeting cut out. There was pieces of linoleum from the kitchen that were cut out of the floor. There was fingerprint dust in various areas, but they won't tell us what they got or what they didn't get. And I understand that a lot of it they can't tell us.
13 years.
I know.
They can tell you a little something. That's a long time to wait for justice that you haven't gotten yet. Now, did you or anybody in your family ever confront Jake and just say, look, man, we think you're involved in this. Just tell us the truth.
Not really. My brother did confront him pretty early on and said, basically to his face, called him a coward for not protecting my mom. And I will say that first week was such a blur and we were just going through the motions and didn't even realize what Jake was really up to until the day before the funeral. And for him to get out of the hospital specifically so he could go to the funeral and everything, it was almost like his way of getting attention. And here he is at the funeral with women sitting on his lap, and he's sitting back from the room. Here's all four of us kids standing up at the casket and taking the receiving line, and he's sitting clear back towards, you know, the middle of the room and has these girls sitting on his lap. I understand he just got out of the hospital, but you should be up here by your wife, not back there yapping it up and having a good time with these women on your lap. And he showed no remorse. Even just a week or two after the funeral, anybody that would say anything to him, he'd say, she'd want me to be happy. I got to carry on my life. And he told people, we had a sexless marriage. I needed to move on. Who says that 2 weeks after their wife dies, is murdered?
That's disturbing.
Yeah. People in the neighborhood said that they saw him at one of these little country restaurants out in Greene County, and the two of them are in a booth making out. Good God, you're too old to be doing that kind of stuff. You're basically insulting my mother by what you're doing.
Now, have you contacted him recently or anything, or does the family have no contact with him?
No contact whatsoever.
Now, what law enforcement agencies in charge of this?
The Pennsylvania State Police.
And when's the last time you spoke to them?
Trooper Petrowski, I talked to, I know I sent him an email, a couple different emails and stuff, within the last 4 or 5 months. Shortly after the Unsolved Mysteries podcast came out, I had been contacted by a couple different people. And so I had called him to ask him if they knew anything about the information that these people had given me. And again, he's like, oh, we'll look into it. Or, yeah, we looked into that, but it wasn't credible. And we just passed it by. And that was typically his response. And then I followed up with phone calls to the DA and the chief detective. Didn't get responses. And I sent these as registered letters. I got the receipts back on them, so I know they got the letters. We did get a letter back from the Elder Justice Court, and apparently they put her case into a database. But I did finally get a hold of the Chief County Detective, Jesse Caldwell, and super nice guy. He's young, and he even said when Marjorie Fox, the past DA, when she retired, he said, I'm not making excuses. He said, but the transition of knowledge and cases and what have you was not done properly. He said, unfortunately, I didn't even know anything about your mom's case until I got your letter and you started calling. And he said, when I started looking into it, he said, I almost felt sick that I didn't know about this. And so he said he didn't know how much he could do because it is in the Pennsylvania State Police. It's in their hands. So jurisdiction-wise, he didn't know how much he could push them, but he was going to look into some things. And I gave him some information. Somebody had reached out to us and told us to look into the Vidox Society. Have you ever heard of that?
Right. And they're in Pennsylvania.
They're in Philly, yeah. And so I told him about that. He'd never even heard of that. And I said, but I can't contact them. I said, it has to be the investigative agency that contacts them. They won't take it from family and friends. And he was very interested because, and I felt so bad for him. He said, you know how it is here in Greene County. And I said, yeah, it's poor. It's poverty stricken. And they are just going to take everything and just boot it under the rug. And he said, I don't even have a squad car. He said, if I go out on a case and investigate, he said, I have to take my own car. And he said, and if you don't, he gave me his phone number, gave me his email address. He said, if you don't get a hold of me, he said, it's not that I'm ignoring you. He said, I might be working a midnight shift. He said, I'm trying to make ends meet and I'm working a second job. And I'm like, you're the county detective and you're working two jobs. That's pitiful that they can't even pay you a decent salary to be a servant of the county.
Sad.
It's very sad.
Now tell me about what are you and your family doing to get attention to the case? Do you have a Facebook page for your mom's case?
No. I never even thought about that.
I tell a lot of people I talk to, they tell me the same. Oh, I don't ever thought about that. I'm like, yeah, set up a Facebook page for her. We'll call it Justice for Betty Jane McClellan, or Do You Know Who Killed Her? Or something interested. And then just invite all your friends, everybody, share information on the true crime pages and invite people to join. And then you can request if anybody has any tips or anything that, you know, they could send them directly to you and then you could forward them to law enforcement.
Most of what we've done is just, you know, trying to keep her memory alive every year on Facebook, her birthday or Mother's Day or Christmas even, or even on the day that she died. And so we post things. I've been putting out the articles from, what's it called, Greenspeak, the little local newspaper that had put out an article several years ago. And the video that my sisters had done early on, we'll repost that and just different things. Like I said, we've done various things, contacting the police when people have called us or have reached out to us about different things that they've heard or what have you. And it gets really discouraging when they won't respond to you. They don't call you back. They don't give you any kind of an idea whether they've looked into it or not. And sometimes we'll ask them to contact a particular person. And then months later, they're reaching out to us and saying, they never contacted me. And here I am calling Trooper Petrowski back again and saying, seriously, why can't you just reach out to them? Why can't you call them and get their side of the story as to why they believe this person may have had something to do with it? I shouldn't have to do that.
Right.
But it's, I will say it's been, yes, it's been frustrating because I feel like I've become the advocate of the family. My brother and my older sister really don't want to go any further with it. They want to remember mom as she was.
Now, what about, I had read that another guy, an elderly man, was killed.
Noble Wine.
You think there's a connection?
Absolutely. Look at some of the details behind it. Noble was a junk dealer too. He was in the same line of business as Jake. And they found him in his house that had burned. And they thought he had died from smoke inhalation. Well, guess what? He's got a gunshot wound in the back of his head from a .22 pistol. Same size that they shot my mother with.
I don't believe in coincidences, especially in a small area like that.
Absolutely. And then there was no other after that.
Now, would you have considered him a competitor with your mom's husband? They were both junk dealers, right?
Not really.
So two junk dealers are shot in a short period of time together. One of them dies, but the other one's wife dies. That's strange. And it's, I don't believe in coincidences. So it sounds like there could be something there, but
yeah,
hard to say.
And the one detective from Allegheny County that's in the video that my sisters did, he had come to the house a couple of days after mom had died. We were there cleaning up some stuff and getting stuff for her for the funeral and stuff. And him and another detective stopped by and talked to us. And they talked like they were going to be involved, that they felt that there was some possible federal issues involved and stuff. And they were gung-ho they were going to get involved in this. Never heard another word out of them.
A lot of people tell me the same thing. Yep. You know, in other cases, they'll get a law enforcement officer who seems gung-ho, and then they just disappear and they never hear from them again. Seems to be common. And the last question that I'd have for you tonight is, for anyone that's out there that's listening to the sound of your voice, if they know anything about what happened to your mother, what would you say to that person or persons?
Why'd it take so long? What are you hiding? You definitely didn't deserve it. My biggest fear is that whoever did it is somebody that knew her and adored her like everybody else. And I have no idea why they would do that to her.
And that concludes the story of Betty Jane McClellan. Who killed this beloved grandmother and why? Her children are trying to find out why she was murdered. They haven't learned any new details from law enforcement. Was Betty's murder connected to Noble Wines? His murder is also unsolved. And who were the two men in the white van? There were so many questions and no answers. To report information about Betty Jane McClellan or Noble Wine, please contact Pennsylvania Crime Stoppers at 1-800-4PA-TIPS. I will also include this information in the story notes. And if you are a parent, law enforcement official, friend, or relative seeking justice for an unsolved homicide case, please visit my website and complete the contact form. You can also contact me through Facebook. Thank you for listening.